Hello, everybody. Thank you for joining me with the War College. This is the second year of the War College at Celesticon. And we have a slate of wonderful speakers. Leland Erickson had spoken yesterday about the myths of the 1940 French campaign. And he's taking a totally different place. He's taking us to a totally different place today with the Chinese warlords of the 20s and the 30s. And we're going to hear some fascinating information about the last Chinese emperor and these warlords and how they try to take over China. We don't hear a lot about that, so I thought that this would be a wonderful topic. Thank you so much for bringing it to us. And without further ado, go ahead and turn down the lights a little bit. Leland Erickson.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Well, this is a little-known period in the West. And it's a period of China's history that the Chinese tend to just assume blow off and forget. They consider it an age of nothing but a bunch of glorified bandits. They're not entirely wrong. The whole of China's history itself is huge. I mean, it would fill many, many weeks to begin to do it any justice. I'm taking you on a snapshot, just a little slice of it, but a pivotal slice, sort of a milestone, if you will, between China's departing from the old ancient and traditional dynastic way of doing things to a more modern take on the dynastic traditional way of doing things. They basically changed the names and brought in Western technology. We begin with 1911, the revolution of 1911, and the abdication of the last emperor, Puyi. Okay. What happened basically was the Qing dynasty, which was an ethnic Manchu dynasty, was not popular with the majority Chinese, and it was corrupt, and it was basically on its last legs. And on top of that, China had been slowly being dissected piece by piece, treaty port by treaty port, by various foreign interests, mainly the European powers. So, bringing us to 1911, the emperor is out. He has been forced to abdicate. The dynasty is gone. It's no more. It's replaced with a republican form of government by a gentleman named... This is actually... What on earth? Did I change that?
I think you went past the slide you're looking for.
The next one? Okay.
No, I meant to have this up. My apologies. This is China in the 1920s. So you can see this could be... Except for the bicycle, it hasn't changed much in over 500 years, really. The attire is much the same. The way things are made are the same. Traditions and pastimes are the same. This snake handler doing his plying his trade is the same. Nothing's changed except now we're starting to see Western things sneaking in. And this caused a lot of concerns. But again, things haven't changed much. Except now maybe rickshaws are being made with Western-style bicycle tires and so on. And, of course, Westerners are now living in China, doing business in China, taking advantage of very lopsided treaties in trade. But for the Chinese, things remain much the same. And again, for the Chinese, this woman's attire hasn't changed in centuries. Her way of life hasn't changed in centuries. It's a sucker bet she's illiterate. Most Chinese were, a huge margin. Most were peasants, tilled the land, lived hand to mouth, and hoped that they made enough extra to pay their taxes to their landlord and still be able to survive and not starve to death. Again, things are done much the same. You want to move goods and people for an event or whatever, you hired a bunch of coolies to carry your litters. This gentleman, Sun Yat-sen. Sun Yat-sen is considered the father of the modern Chinese Republic. He's Western-educated, a Chinese convert. He longed to see China unified once again, basically as to stand on her own feet and not be run over by the European powers. He was the one who was played a major part in the overthrow of the Qing dynasty and wanted to establish a modern democratic republic in China based upon Western models. Did I mention he's a Christian convert? He was undermined by the political maneuverings of a supposed ally within the Kuomintang, which was their nationalist party of China, and supposed to be a fellow cohort revolutionary trying to bring a democratic republic to China. And that would be
He died in 1925, and unfortunately for him, his dream of a unified China hadn't taken place. Next slide, please. Now, this gentleman, Yuan Shikai was the guy that outmaneuvered Sun Yat-sen. He became head of the Kuomintang. He became essentially the president of the republic. And then he decided, no, I'm the emperor, when he said so. And, oh boy, that's when things got interesting. Because when Yuan Shikai declared himself the new son of heaven and wanted to declare a new dynasty, it immediately caused the whole house of cards of Kuomintang, China's a republic, we're becoming a modern power, to collapse. All the provincial warlords and governors basically said, no, if you can be the son of heaven, we're not doing this republican thing, well then I can be the son of heaven. And I control Shaanxi, or I control Hunan. So you know what? Forget you, Yuan Shikai. Boom, whole thing blows up. Well, this is around the time of World War I. Remember, the revolution was 1911. So this is around 1915-16. And of course, China gets leaned on real hard by the European powers, especially Great Britain, to do something to help us against the Hun. So China's providing laborers mainly to the British. China is in no position to argue. Japan, of course, has, because the Europeans are all distracted, Japan, who's had imperial ambitions on mainland since the 1890s, decides to lean on China and say, give us Shandong, you know, the German concession, we want it. And of course, China's government being disarray thanks to this knucklehead's ambitions, well, they kind of give it up to the Japanese, and they kind of roll over. So creating a mess, you can see we're already getting a chaotic mess here. You've got provincial governors who are already halfway out the door saying, I'm a warlord, this is my turf, I'm going to be the next emperor. If you can do it, I can do it too. This guy's flailing around trying to hold things together and get everybody behind him. The party's in disarray. You basically have paralysis setting in the government in China. And it was already weak because of centuries of corruption building up within the imperial dynasty that had just been deposed, and of course the Europeans moving in and helping themselves, because China was, as I showed you, still in the 1600s. Except for whatever European weapons they had been able to procure here and there, willy-nilly, China's still 17th century, 18th century. You know, the musket, you know, we can make muskets. So there's the problem, is you've got this going on. Next slide, please. So World War I ends, and the Chinese Civil War, the Age of the Warlords, begins in earnest. And various individuals who control different regions are now asserting themselves. Yuan Shikai died in 1916. That's when things start really going flying apart. So by 1919, World War I ends. European powers are exhausted. America's like back to business. They have the open door policy. We just want to do business. We don't want to be bothered. We should be free to trade wherever we want. And we have gunboats to enforce that. And the Europeans have the same attitude as, look, we're exhausted. We don't want to get embroiled. And, oh, we don't, by the way, we don't care to promote violence around the world, so we're going to embargo arms. Well, that's official. In practice, it's a whole other story. This is a perfect example of these ambitious fellows that rose up in the wake of Yuan Shikai. This is Shang Solin. He is the fellow controlling Manchuria. He is an ethnic Manchurian, like the old Manchu dynasty. And he's a pretty sharp guy. He was of humble birth. He was originally a leader of a Manchurian militia unit that assisted the Japanese in the Russo-Japanese War. He had close ties to the Japanese, obviously. He was educated by them in military arts. Now, he held various military posts under the Chinese Republic. In 1918, he's appointed Inspector General of Manchuria, and he controlled it until his death. And from 1920, he was in a constant state of war to extend his rule southward, and he got involved in a three-way struggle with the warlord Wu Peifu and the supposedly Christian warlord Feng Yuxiang for control of the Beijing government. Remember, they've split apart, everybody's squabbling. Everybody wants a peace. And everybody, by the way, is ostensibly saying, I want the republic, I'm representing the republic. So their soldiers all wear the five-colored, five-pointed star of the republic on their uniforms because they all are trying to claim legitimacy. So, anywho, moving along with our pal here, Chang Sin Lo Solin. Basically, his Feng Tian army occupies Beijing and the Tianjin area in 1926, but then they get driven out by the Northern Expedition within a year. He basically dies when his train is blown up by his erstwhile allies, the Japanese, while he's traveling across Manchuria. See, the Japanese decided we can't control this guy any longer, he's becoming a pain in the ass, and we got to be rid of him. So they did. And then his son takes over, and that'll be Chang Shui Liang, and he succeeds him in control, and the Japanese have a little more say in what the son does. I think the son kind of got the message. You know, your old man's not towing our line anymore. We aren't going to put up with that. Basically, this man here is a very sharp cookie as far as it goes. But again, it's China's so divided at this juncture that the squabbling is just unbelievable. There's nobody can form alliance. This is Wu Peifu. This was his major rival. They each formed alliances with other warlords, and that was another part of the problem. The warlords are all trying to form alliances one with others and get them on board. But the problem is, everybody wants to be the boss. And so, one minute you have an alliance and you've got an advantage and you just want a war, or a short war, or a battle, and the next minute, the guys, wait a minute, where are you guys? And that's how it shifted. The alliances tended to shift.
They should go overboard with their costumes, don't they?
Oh, please, you know, I'm the boss, you know, and I'm a great guy. I got this award for this and this award. I mean, come on, this is how great I am.
How much disorder was there at the local level at this point?
It went from region to region. There were over, 140 separate wars during the period of the, I think it was 1918 to 1926, over 100 wars recorded in this. And of course, a war could last a couple of days, but it could involve literally several hundred thousand troops on a side, and it would be an actual fight or series of fights that would break out between the rival warlords. Some of them commanded fairly huge armies. There were lots of petty warlords running around. I'm just introducing you to some of the big dogs, but there were lots of petty warlords running around. Some of them are a little better than bandit leaders. In this period, the soldiers, their loyalty shifts constantly. The common soldiers' lot, which I'll get into a little later, it was not a pretty one, and they basically were doing it to keep from, they would join to keep from starving. They're overwhelmingly, the common soldiers were illiterate peasants, and they just couldn't find work or make ends meet, or they got kicked off their land by a landlord or whatever. So for whatever reason, the choice was be a soldier, which was, at this point in China's history, still regarded as the lowest possible rung of society, below a homeless vagabond thief or what have you. So it was not sought of very highly, and soldiers were regarded as nothing but armed thugs. And in practice, they pretty much were in this period. They preyed upon the peasants ruthlessly. They often weren't paid, and they weren't fed regularly by their officers. Supposedly, the story goes in one case, some of the soldiers said, well, what about, you know, we're going to get something to eat? And an officer scoffed at them and said, you have a gun, don't you? You know? Basically, go get it. You know, the town's over there. You got guns. Go get something to eat.
They didn't have ammunition, though.
Well,
ammunition.
Wait till we'll get to that. I have some fun for you on that point. So anyway, Wu here is the son of a tradesman. He joined the famous Bei Yang army of Yuan Shikai, and he became a leading general of the Qing Dynasty army. And basically, this guy was good, and he rapidly rose. So Yuan Shikai thought this guy has promise. Thing is, after Yuan dies in 1916, he becomes the chief bulwark of the Beijing government, which, of course, as I said, it's like falling apart at the seams. In 1922, he got into his fight with Chang Solin, whom we just met. And basically, because Chang was extending his control, spreading it out into the north, and he was getting closer to Beijing. And, of course, Wu thought, oh, no, you don't. So Wu, of course, secures his position in central China. And basically, there's a series of battles. He manages to drive Zhang Xiaolin's army back into Manchuria. So Zhang goes back up home to lick his wounds and regroup. And Zhang does not sit around and do nothing. We'll come to that later. Zhang Xiaolin is quite an interesting character. Anyway, moving along here with Wu. He basically was known for ruthlessly suppressing worker strikes on the Bay when the Beijing Hankou Railroad in 1923, but that, by doing so, he lost most of his popularity. So that was Wu. Wu basically winds up continuing with his nonstop rivalry with Zhang Zuolin. They go back and forth in a whole series of battles and campaigns, and in the end, by 1927, Wu is basically beaten and politically outmaneuvered, and he's forced to flee. And what happens is he actually he flees to Sichuan in 1927 in the face of Chiang Kai-shek's northern expedition. And from there, he winds up retiring to Beijing. He finally says, "Look, I'm out of the game." And Chiang Kai-shek takes him at his word and lets him retire. And he just stays in Beijing, retired until he dies in 1932. So he fades away. And this is kind of how these warlords often go. They rise and they squabble with each other, and they sort of attrition each other out of the picture. And then Chinese politics being what it is, at a certain point, a certain critical mass, they're not necessarily going to get killed by a rival. They might just sort of retire, and they've lost so much face, they bow out and they go away and they fade into obscurity. Next slide, please. This next guy's a fun one. This is Feng Yuxiang. Feng Yuxiang is the Christian warlord. He's also fond of things Western. He is literate. He is his Christian faith, I guess, is best summed up by the way he insisted that his soldiers learn to be or become Christians. He was known to baptize them unit by unit with a garden hose. That was his idea of how you baptize your soldiers with a garden hose. Feng Yuxiang liked to cultivate, you know, an image of being this Christian warlord, this forward-thinking man, this moral and upright man. In many ways, he was, but there's no doubting this man's ambitions. He was a fierce. He basically did what a lot of the warlords did, which was trying to play both ends off against the middle. He was alternately be in cahoots with one like Wu Peifu or Zhang Zuolin, and then the next minute he'd turn around and say, "You know what? No, I'm not supporting him anymore." And it's like, "But wait a minute. What do you mean? I'm hanging out here in the breeze, and now I'm in this fight with this other warlord, and yeah, you're saying no, you won't help me. Thanks." This is the way their relationships would go. Next slide, please. Duan Qi. This is also him on the cover of Time. Again, the Chinese Christian warlord. You know, he made Time magazine. He was very good about cultivating PR with the West.
What year was that, please?
Pardon me?
What year was this?
Let's see if I can make it out on the screen here.
Can I get out, Dana? This is volume number. No, it'd be year.
I have to check it at home on. I have to check my where I got it online, but it's this would be the 1920s. He didn't last past the Northern Expedition either.
All right, so it's before 1927.
Yeah. Next slide, please. Okay, this is originally an ally of Yuan Shikai. This is Duan Qiri, and our man here, Duan. Basically, he splits with his old boss over when Yuan Shikai declares himself emperor. Now, he's a soldier from the beginning of his career. He was in action in the Boxer Rebellion, fighting, so helping to suppress the Boxers. He was with the loyalist Beiyan Army during the Revolution, and he was one of their more effective commanders, trying to suppress the Republican Revolution of 1911. However, at the end, the rebels won, despite the fact that Duan Qirui had defeated them and recaptured Han Yang and Han Cao from them. So when Yuan Shikai forces the Emperor Puyi to abdicate, Duan Qirui actually sides with Yuan, and he gets rewarded for that loyalty, gets the governorship of Hunan and Hubei provinces. He also gets a cabinet ministry post as Minister of War in 1912. And then, of course, the two start falling out. As I said, when Yuan Shikai says, "I'm the emperor," Duan says, "What?" And so these two start falling out big time. And so the political wrangling and maneuvering starts. And so in a typical move, to placate and also to basically disempower one's new rival, Yuan Shikai makes him a premier, except that he, before he made him premier, he stripped the office of all authority. So, meaningless title. You're now premier, Duan. See, I still value your loyalty. I know you're loyal. Yeah, thanks, boss. So Duan Kiri basically would be a government official. And he was, but one of the things he did, which really blew up the whole thing for him in the end, during the period of the First World War, China wants to modernize their army. Well, nobody's going to give them a loan because China's credit ain't so good at this point. So he goes to the Japanese behind closed doors and he negotiates a series of loans. And these loans are really not very favorable to China. Basically, the Japanese are being a loan shark. And they know it because they want a piece of China. In fact, they would love to get all of it one day. But Duan makes the deal with the devil. And when these loans come out, it causes a huge blowback. Among popular Chinese opinion, it leads to rioting in the streets, really. The Chinese national sentiment is one of, look, we are sick of the foreigners. Japanese, European, whatever. We're sick of them, and we're sick of our own selling us out piece by piece to them. So they saw this as another one, yet one more case of someone in government selling us out. And so this causes Duan's career to kind of, he's double dealing. It basically blows up on him. This was really part of his nature. His whole career is marked by double dealing, trying to play one faction off against the other. Where the loans are where it blew up and led to the protests. It blew the coalition government apart. His southern provincial rivals of the Zhili clique turned on him. His own Anhui clique went after the Zhili clique as a result, and there was a short war from July 14 to the 18th of 1920. And despite the fact that Duan's army is trained by the Japanese and armed by the Japanese, he gets clobbered. They hand his troops their tail, and that's it. So this is the end of Duan Kirui, and he basically, this hapless former chief executive of China, he goes into a self-imposed exile and eventually dies in Shanghai in 1936. He, again, rise, fall, obscurity, see you later. That's kind of goes. Next slide, please. Chiang Kai-shek, the generalissimo himself. He's the head of the Kuomintang that we all remember from popular history.
He wins because he has the fastest
uniform. Exactly. Of course he's the winner. He's got the best duds.
He's definitely the best epaulets.
I'm telling you, if I ever do a costume, I must have this. I mean, this is just... this is. I mean, who wouldn't want this outfit? My darling, take notes. So anyway, he manages to unify the country eventually up in 1927, so the upper arc of the, today's talk. He basically starts his career as a soldier. He is also trained in Japan. A lot of the Chinese Republican partisans were trained in Japan, or educated and trained in Japan, or in the West,
I thought they were doing the Wampung military camp.
Yeah, that too. They, in the case of Shang, he trained in Japan. He served in the Japanese army, and that's where he fell in with a bunch of Chinese expats being educated and trained in China, or excuse me, in Japan. So he falls in with them, and they're all conspiring to bring a republic, get rid of the Manchus. So he's like, yeah, that's cool, I'm in. He joins them. When he returns to China, he gets there back in time for the outbreak of the revolution of 1911. So he, of course, at first, he's with Yuan Shikai. You know, they're all about the republic. Then Yuan does his thing and says, I'm emperor! And Chiang's like, eh, hell you are. So Chiang Kai-shek's like, okay, no. So he basically settles into Shanghai, and he temporarily drops into obscurity. Basically, he's got to cut and run because Yuan Shikai is too powerful for him at first. And this is where he becomes affiliated with the Green Gang Triad, and a fellow named Du Yusheng. We'll come back to big-eared Du a little later. You'll really like this guy. He's fun. So he returns back into it in 1918 to support Sun Yat-sen, who's trying to create a real proper Republican government. Sun Yat-sen is reorganizing the Kuomintang along Soviet lines, believe it or not. And as a consequence, Chiang Kai-shek travels to the Soviet Union in 1923, and he studies Soviet institutions, especially the Red Army. And he winds up founding the Whampoa Academy, and he builds it on Soviet lines. And as the communists, of course, are admitted into the Kuomintang by Sun Yat-sen, Soviet aid, especially advisors and military advisors, starts flowing into China to help the Kuomintang. Basically, Chiang doesn't like the communists. He likes how they're able to do things, but he doesn't like them, and he doesn't like their ideals. He's still very much a conservative Confucian and a very ambitious fellow in his own right. So he basically starts out maneuvering the communists. He starts placating them. He alternates between showing strength, showing force in a really heavy-handed way, and then turning around and being very lenient. So he's kind of got them confused and wondering, which way is this guy going to swing? Well, he's actually setting them up for the sucker punch. And the Kuomintang, he basically contains their popularity and influence until Sun Yat-sen dies in 1925, and at which point Chiang assumes power of the Kuomintang, and he immediately turns on the communists and the trade unions they've been organizing, and that's 1927, and that's where we get into the bloodbath in Shanghai in 1927 when Chiang turns on the Reds and has them massacred. As the commander of the Wanpo Academy and commander-in-chief of the Kuomintang's military arm, as of 1925, he wasted no time in picking a fight with the independent warlords. That's when he gets going, and he starts going after them one by one. And this, of course, reaches its crescendo by 1927 with his northern expedition, where he basically manages to crush the major northern factions, including Chang So-lin, or rather his offspring. And so he is ostensibly, by 1927, broken the warlords and unified the country. It's very fragile. We'll touch on that a little later. Next one, please. My buddy, Du Yusheng, big ear Du. I think if anybody's evocative of the China, this period, the age of the warlords in China in the 1920s, it can be summed up in Du Yusheng. This man is the godfather of opium. You see, Shanghai was like many worlds in one in the 1920s. It was a foreign treaty port, had a huge foreign concession. It was the hub of foreign trade going in and out of China. One foreigner at the time said that Shanghai has many worlds. It has the best and the worst of everything. That was an old saying among the foreigners. Basically, it's both a in Shanghai, you had everything from colonial elegance to absolute lawlessness in the streets. Just depending on what street you ran, you turned down at night. This is like, it was a place both of romance and just downright nastiness. You had everything going on here. Basically, you had every kind of gangster and racket going on. Opium was the big one, but you had prostitution, protection rackets, gambling, and of course, arms trafficking. Now, Europe has officially got an embargo in the wake of the First World War. Arms are not supposed to come into China. We're not supposed to encourage the locals in killing each other. In practice, it flowed like a river. And China wasn't even a major arms market, but it was very lucrative for anybody that wanted to get in on it. So basically, and of course, you have all that surplus hardware from the First World War. Suddenly, you've got just literally hundreds of thousands of metric tons of munitions, guns, everything, anything. And the warlords wanted to get their hands on it. Every warlord wanted new toys. Every warlord needed new toys in order to make an army and overpower his rivals. So they were all there and getting their fingers into Shanghai.
Was this the period when the Indiana Jones 2 movie was set?
That, I would say, is actually a little later in the 30s. Shanghai has not improved at that point. But it's essentially the same feel, the same kind of chaos. You have all that glitz, that Vegas-style glitz, Chinese glitz and so on, glamour going on. And you have guys like Du Yusheng. I love this guy. He's just so rotten.
Well, he was the Green Gang?
Yeah. He's the head of the Green Gang. Now, here's what happens with Big Ear Du. His career, he basically starts his career as a thug and an enforcer for the Green Gang. He's a literate knucklehead peasant. He's got nothing better to his life. He has, he has no moral compass, the detectable moral compass, and he'll do anything. So he's a perfect guy. So he joins up with the Green Gang in Shanghai as a thug and an enforcer, a muscle man. Well, he's so good at what he does, enforcing the Green Gang's protection rackets and so on, that he gains the notice of the bosses, and they're like, yeah, this guy's young, he's tough, and he's good, and he's smart, and he's got ambition. So you know, within 5 years, he's climbed the ladder. He's head of the Green Gang. I mean, this guy is like, makes Don Corleone look like a slacker. He makes Scarface look like a slacker. Okay, so he's got himself, he basically runs the Green Gang. Well, basically what he did is his old boss lost face because his old boss got arrested. For whatever reason, his connections with the local authorities, the foreign authorities, fell apart. He gets arrested, he loses face, the boss must retire. Du was his number two. Du stepped in. Du wastes no time. He tightens his grip over their enterprises, and he cultivates a very handy working relationship with the chief of detectives in the French concessions guard municipal. See, every foreign concession had its own police department. Every foreign concession policed its turf, and they had their own Chinese police department. Now, the fun part about Shanghai at this time, in every foreign concession, the criminal triads, especially the Green Gang, they had corrupted the police thoroughly. They controlled the police, except in the French concession. In the French concession, the Green Gang was the police. I'm not exaggerating. All the Chinese detectives, all their in the guard municipal, they belonged to the Green Gang.
So they wear regular uniforms? Did they have regular police?
They were both plain clothes, and they were uniformed colonial police. They looked, you know, paramilitary type uniform. But mainly the bottom line is uniform, street cop, or plain clothes, they belong to the Green Gang if they were in the French Guard Municipal. So that's money talks, especially when you're dealing with something like opium. You try to smuggle opium through the French concession without the Green Gang's approval, the police conveniently managed to always turn up and raid your shipment. And of course, they would make a big deal of it in the local press. Oh, we capture all these drugs. Now we've disposed of them. What happened to the drugs? We disposed of them. And conveniently, the next day, the Green Gang is selling them and pocketing the money. This is how things rolled in Shanghai, in the French concession. In the others, somebody got a bribe, they looked the other way, and the shipment goes through. They got a cut, everybody's happy. This was Shanghai in the 1920s, the roaring 20s. But Big Ear Du, he's quite the character. And remember, he's pals with Chiang Kai-shek. They seem to hit it off. Well, Big Ear Du essentially has a business arrangement with Chiang, and he starts bankrolling him. And Du's got a big, big personal fortune he's piled up. He loves the finer things in life. He had a number of official wives. He had a whole bunch of concubines. He lived in a big old mansion in the French Quarter, which, if my memory serves correct, it's become a hotel. It's still there. It still stands, but it's a hotel now, to give you an idea of its size. And, of course, Du finances Chiang Kai-shek. He lends the Kuomintang money, and he does more than that. When Chiang decides to turn on the communists, Du puts the Green Gang at his disposal to pinpoint and identify the communists within Shanghai, and the Green Gang either leads Kuomintang troops to the various communist groups where they're killed and or assists them in killing the communists. So several thousands died. Over 5,000 workers were killed when Chiang turned on the communists and decided to purge the party. And that was just in Shanghai. So again, it was chaos. It was horrific, and basically, most of the people that were killed were simply workers who were standing up saying, "Look, I'd like to make something at least enough that I can feed myself and my family. You know, that's all I'm asking for. I'm asking for enough. You know, not that we're constantly hungry and can't or living on the streets. But no, so much for that. He provides so much money and so on. He gains so much." Chiang Kai-shek gets so beholden to this guy, Chiang Kai-shek appoints him a general in the Kuomintang army. And when the Japanese show up in 1937 and decide, you know what, nice treaty port, we'll take it. And they're there to stay. It's not like 1931, they show up, they make a show of force, and they leave. 37, they came in force, and they were clearly going to stay and take over the whole city. Big Ears Du goes crazy because he knows the Japanese want the opium trade. That's why they want Shanghai, because that's the money, that's the cash cow of Shanghai, is the opium trafficking. It is the hub, the world's opium traffic at this point in history. So he raises hell to his friend Chiang Kai-shek. Chiang Kai-shek is so beholden to Big Ear Du, he can't deny him. He sends the absolute best divisions of his army. These are German-trained and equipped divisions of the Kuomintang army. They're considered the elite. He sends them to Shanghai, and they get destroyed. And Du is forced to flee, is basically forced to drop out of sight and lay low. And of course, Shang has now lost his best troops, and it's a mess. But again, this shows you what happens when you get yourself beholden to somebody like Big Ear Du. Well, Big Ear Du manages to flee Shanghai in the wake of the Japanese occupation. He remains at large and eventually winds up in Hong Kong. And when Mao's communists win in 1949, in the end, he basically stays in Hong Kong, and he passes away peacefully in 1951, untroubled by the legacy of his being one of the most notorious gangsters in history. Next slide, please. Okay, guess who? Mao Zedong, my man Mao. I actually teach his Yu Chi Chan as part of a larger course at the school. This guy, I got to give it to him, he's one of the greatest strategists that I think's ever lived in the 20th century, just because he was cunning and was in it for the long haul. And he outlasted everybody. He's a fervent Chinese nationalist at heart. He wants to restore China to her former status and glory. He loves to equate himself to the first emperor, Qin Shi Huangdi, because he thinks he's basically the same kind of guy, father of a unified China. His patience is off the charts. His thoughtfulness as a strategist, I say go read his On Guerrilla Warfare, the Yu Chi Chan, if you want to understand what he's about. Just keep one thing in mind when you read the Yu Chi Chan, the On Guerrilla Warfare. He wrote that during the time that he had a unified front against Japan with Chiang Kai-shek and the nationalists. So the reason he makes certain points in telling his followers to basically wage the guerrilla war, you're part of the bigger war, you're there to support the national army. He's playing for time. He's building his network. He's constantly building the network of his Chinese peasants' army. And he knows that the long term, Japan will lose. They cannot win. They're in an asymmetric conflict. They cannot win. And that, in fact, was what was going on. By the time Japan attacked Pearl Harbor, they had already, at least privately, were admitting, the Japanese army, that this is a quagmire. We can't control this. This is out of control. This is bigger than we can handle. But they were still stuck in. Yeah, the Japanese are saying that about their invasion of China. They're stuck in. But anyway, at this time, in the 1920s, he's just one more player, and he's neither a smaller player. He's still trying to build up the communists, and of course they take a huge hit with the massacre in Shanghai when the China communists are purged from the Kuomintang by Chiang Kai-shek. So this, of course, leads to a chain of events that leads to his long march, where he disappears with his followers. They disappear into the hinterlands and go off to regroup.
How invested was Mao in Shanghai prior to the Shanghai?
Mao's investment in Shanghai is essentially political and ideological, and that is all. His investment is that, you know, we want to spread the revolution and make China strong again and get the foreigners out. Pardon me?
How many cadres did you use in Shanghai?
Cadres, I couldn't tell you, but I could, like I said, the body count was somewhere in like the thousands, over 5,000.
As I recall, Mao was not in charge of that. It was the result of the massacre that he became a surviving Chinese communist leader. Am I wrong on that?
I don't think so. I think you are correct. I want to stay focused on this slice, the 1920s.
Okay.
So at this point, his presence is that he's coming up. He's somebody that's somewhat in the background. He's on his way up. Next slide, please. This is another one of my... This is China as it splinters into the warlord zones, and the various warlords controlling various slices. If I remember the legend correctly, the Kuomintang, I think, are controlling this. But again, you could just, the reason I have it up, I just want to show you how divided the country is. It's as bad as the Warring States period from which the first empire arose. Everybody's at everybody. They're bickering back and forth. They're, like I said, there are over 140 wars recorded during this period. So it's like a constant state of warfare. For the Chinese peasant, which is the vast majority of the population, this is a period of banditry. This is a period of lawlessness. This is a real unpleasant time to be alive. This is kind of why I somewhat tongue-in-cheek called this this talk a fistful of yuan, like a fistful of dollars, you know, like the Wild West, because in a lot of ways it is. Next slide, please. This man, Sir Basil, and I say sir in quotes, Sir Basil Zaharoff. Say hello to the original Merchant of Death. This character, and he's a character, a lot of the facts about him, well, there aren't, because it's hard to get, because he burned all his papers at the end of his life. A lot of stuff that would have given a good paper trail to any investigator or historian to try to figure out who this clown really was and where he came from. There's no question about it, he was a very successful arms trafficker. He would sell to anybody. Basically, he passed in the 1927, that's when he was burning all his papers. He destroyed 58 years worth of diaries recording every detail of his career, which is really kind of sad. He was dubbed the mystery man of Europe by the press. He's still considered something of an impenetrable enigma. He acquired a really scandalous reputation. He was known as Basil Zaharoff, a.k.a. Count Zaharoff, a.k.a. Prince Zacharias Basilius Zaharoff, known to his intimates as ZZ, like double zero. He was born in Anatolia, part of the Ottoman Empire, probably around 1849. He was known to be a brothel tout, that is somebody who announced, hey, the girls are here, come get them. A bigamist, an arsonist, and a benefactor of great universities and an intimate of royalty. And he reeked, and of course the peak of his infamy is as an international arms dealer. And his enemies called him a merchant of death, and he actually seemed to like the title. He was more than a match for Aleister Crowley as being the wickedest man alive in the world. He's still remembered as an inventor of the System Zaharoff. Basically, it's his technique of how to sell weapons successfully. You basically trump up a conflict between two parties, and then you sell to both. And in his case, he did this. He made his fortune working for the British armaments firm Vickers. He became like their super salesman. He served them for 30 years. They considered them as officially their general representative abroad. He basically expressed no objection to being called the armaments king. His youth is shrouded in mystery and rumor, and basically much of it was put out by him. He supposedly was born in Anatolia, again, the son of a Greek importer of roses, I gather, and he basically proved that he had a knack for languages, supposedly could master, he says he could master 10 languages, or he could speak 10 languages. Supposedly, the family moved to Odessa and Russia's Black Sea coast, and they Russified their name to Zaharoff. There's real documentation surviving, though. So again, you know what we're trying to piece, what people are trying to piece together about this guy. It's very hard. As one early biographer, the Austrian Robert Newman, put it: "You ask for his birth certificate. Alas, a fire destroyed the church registers. You search for a document concerning him in the archives of the Vienna War Office. The folder is there, but it is empty. The document has vanished. He buys a chateau in France, and how does the story of the editor of the Documents Politiques go? Sir Basil Zaharoff at once buys up all the picture postcards which show the chateau and strictly prohibits any more photographs be taken." He knows how to cover his tracks. This guy gets heavily involved in the trafficking of arms through Shanghai. Let me go ahead, next slide. It's another picture of our pal ZZ. See, this is how he liked everybody to see him. I think this picture captured the eyes beautifully. I think I'm looking at a reptile in the herbarium. As near as I can tell, looking up, reading about Zaharov, the guy has no scruples. But he has lots of ambition. Amongst other things, he wants to be legit. And so he puts a lot of pressure out there as he's ingratiating himself to Vickers to become given something, a knighthood. He craved that like nobody's business. Basically, let's see, there's a great piece here I dug up on him. Here we go. Using sundry aliases, he set up as a storekeeper and boldly unscrupulous contractor. According to the fellow who became the Greek prime minister in 1915, it was during these years that Zaharov was first hired as an arms salesman, becoming Balkan representative for a small Swedish firm run by the inventor Thorsten Nordenfelt. True or not, Zaharov slipped back into Britain after Cyprus passed to English control after 1878. By 1883, he seems to have established in Galway in Ireland, where he posed as a count, working as a shipping agent, and was sent death threats for persuading local girls to emigrate in search of factory work in Massachusetts. Given 24 hours to leave the country by his angry hosts, Zaharov fled to the United States himself, where he built a career in railroads. It appears that he was the Count Zakharov, who in Utah in 1884 claimed to be in possession of, quote, four black diamonds that played a celebrated part in the Russo-Turkish War, and who a year later caused a small scandal in Missouri by associating with the notorious Madame Pearl Clifford, one of the most beautiful and soiled doves ever known in St. Louis. While working as superintendent of a local railway sleeping car company, he was certainly the Count Zakharov who, hastily promoting himself to the eminence of Prince Zacharias Basilius Zakharov, married the New York heiress Jeannie Billings for her $150,000 and her expectations later in 1885, and found himself the subject of a transatlantic police hunt when an expatriate Bristol businessman denounced him as a bigamist. Are we having fun yet with this guy? This guy is like, he's just one of the classic grifters, con men, shysters of history. According to the Omaha Daily Bee, they gave a good summary of Zaharov's methods in the period. He maintains a high social position by means of letters from prominent society people which purported to be genuine, and had a library full of documents which he claimed were written to him by European dignitaries. He claimed to be a nephew of the Russian Chancellor Prince Gortschakov, and told a remarkable story of his banishment by the Tsar. At one time, he created a considerable commotion among the set here, in which he moved by threatening to go abroad and fight a duel with a Prussian prince who had dared to insult his mother. Relocating yet again in the wake of the Billing scandal, ZZ returns to Greece in the Ottoman Empire, and during the later 1880s, he certainly was involved in touting Nordenfelt's two principal inventions, a multi-barrel machine gun and a steam-powered submarine. Now, of course, this is where we get the Methodique Zaharov, where he basically plays on the tensions between the Greeks and the Turks, and he sells to both because of that tension. Now, here's the catch about the Nordenfelt submarines. They're steam-powered. They're notoriously unreliable. They're notoriously unstable when submerged. They are very dangerous. They're basically death traps. And he manages to sell multiple units to both sides. This is Zed's trick. Well, now, along comes somebody named Sir Hiram Maxim, the guy who invents the Maxim gun. And at an expose in England, basically, ZZ intrigues to get in cahoots with Hiram Maxim. And this is how he does it. It's described by none other than H.G. Wells, who was witness to the event. Maxim exhibited his gun at Vienna. When he fired his gun at a target and demonstrated its power, Zaharov was busy explaining to expert observers that the whole thing was an exhibition of skill, that only Maxim could fire the gun. It would take years to train men to use it, that these new machines were delicate and difficult to make and could not be produced in quantities and so forth. Maxim, after tracing the initials of the Austrian Emperor upon a target, prepared to receive orders. There were none forthcoming. He learned that the Nordenfelt was simple and strong. This gun of his was a scientific instrument unfit for soldierly hands. His demonstration went for nothing. What had happened? He realized he was vis-a-vis with a salesman. A very formidable salesman. In the end, he amalgamated with the salesman. He brought Zaharov in the fold because he realized this man can sell my guns. If he could shut down my trying to pitch them, he could sell them. And so that begins his association with Maxim, and interned with Vickers. And this is where he's the guy. And what is, to sum up his skill and why Vickers kept him on so long, he knew who to bribe and when to bribe them. Next slide, please. General Joe Stilwell, just a quick note on him. He's a young Army officer at this time. He's traveling the back roads of China. He's making observations for the Army, and he's an engineer by training, so he's helping with municipal projects. It is during this time that he develops his tight affection for the Chinese people and his contempt for the Chinese government, and and it develops a genuine desire to see the Chinese people get a better deal. So during this time, he's learning his way around China on foot. He's learning the language, he's understanding the people, and he's getting a feel for them, and he's becoming very sympathetic to them. And that would affect the rest of his career. Next slide, please. Okay, one of my favorite people, Morris Two Gun Cohen. Two Gun Cohen is a Cockney Jew, a thug, a ne'er-do-well, a tough guy, a hooligan, a gambler, a pickpocket, a carouser, who by chance circumstances around 1906 falls in with the Chinese expats up in Canada. And Morris happens to walk in. He basically loves it there because that's where the gambling den is, and they don't hold him to any kind of moral code, and they don't hold him to any rules. He's just one more guy that comes in and eats the Chinese food and gambles in the back room, and he's cool. And he seems interested in sitting and listening to the restaurant owner tell him about China. And so he's good with it. And so he's a cool guy. Well, one evening he comes in, he wants some Chinese cuisine, and he wants to do a little gambling. And he sees this other guy up at the front there who has the owner gunpoint. And for whatever reason, Two Gun Cohen, intervenes. He walks up quickly to the robber, decks him, knocks him out cold, saves the restaurant owner. At that point, he's in, like Flynn with the Chinese, Republican expats. Because those Chinese that ran that restaurant and the gambling dens and all the rest of the rackets in Canada at the time, they were backing Chiang Kai-shek and Sun Yat-sen. And guess who that is? That's Morris Two Gun Cohen. He spent the rest of his life being a bodyguard for Chiang Kai-shek and a trusted go-between and messenger for the Kuomintang. That was his whole life. There's a great book by Daniel Levy, Morris, it's Two Gun Cohen, and I strongly recommend it. This guy is the epitome of Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, the High Road to China. This guy's for real. He's the real deal. I really wish someone would make a movie about him. Because he's just the stocky, grumpy, nasty, tough guy, little Cockney Jew, who basically fell in with the Chinese nationalists. Next slide, please. Okay, that's Cohen again, right there in the middle, sitting with his pals in the Kuomintang. But yeah, to the end of his days.
What two guns did he carry?
He always had two pistols. He usually had two pistols. Now, we move to the fun stuff. What the warlord got for his hard-earned Mexican silver dollars? I kid you not. Silver dollars minted in Mexico, they were one of the favorite cash payments for arms under the table in Shanghai. Well, we have post-World War I surplus. And typically a squad of warlord soldiers, you have a dozen men, guess what? You might have a dozen different rifles in the same squad. Now, somebody earlier said, well, do they have bullets? Well, yeah, they may. Somebody may come up with a cart, dump the pile of bullets, and each of you sits around that pile, and I believe it was Stilwell who recounts this in his diary. And one by one, each of you tests a bullet, takes up a bullet, puts it in your rifle, see if it fits. If it fits, you put it in your pocket. If it doesn't fit, you throw it in the discard pile, you go in there the next until you've got enough bullets to fill your pouch. That is how you delve out ammunition in this period. Your assortment of guns could be anything. Everything was available armament-wise. Of course, you had no way to know what you were getting for what you paid for until it actually arrives. And because this is all under the table, if they screw you, you're stuck. There's no recourse. You can't get back at the guy. So I imagine an arms shipment from a warlord, this might be a sample cross-section. And I think if they were half as good looking as these examples, They would be thrilled. But it was catch as catch can. Any kind of weapon, whatever they could get their hands on. The arms deals were just amazing. And another thing, too, another source of armaments. Remember that the First World War has ended, the Russian Civil War has ended, and tens of thousands of former Tsarist soldiers have fled into China, and they brought their weapons with them. And so their officers were engaging with the Chinese to sell them their weapons. Gotta eat. And, of course, many thousands of Russian expat soldiers took service with the Chinese warlords as mercenaries, often forming elite bodyguard units, serving as crews on armored trains, and so on, because they often had a greater technical knowledge. Next slide, please. This is what every warlord wanted the most. A machine gun! Now, of course, here's the problem. They're expensive, because everybody's asking a really big price. Everybody wants one! And again, you have the problem of, yeah, but did bullets come with it? Does it work? Can I get more bullets for it? And then I got to train my knuckleheads to use it. So, enter the Western advisors. There were lots of Western advisors, mercenaries, adventurers, and ne'er-do-wells like our pal Two Gun Cohen or Sir Basil Zed running around, especially through Shanghai. next slide, please. This is what every warlord really wanted. A prestige weapon, a cannon, to make them go boom and scare the other guy's troops and make them run away. Well, these were really hard to come by because they were really expensive. Not everybody's willing to sell them to you. And, of course, remember, there's officially an arms embargo. No, we can't encourage the locals to kill each other. No, we just came through the Great War. That's not proper. Okay, my meetings with his representative, Sir Basil, at 6 o'clock, right. Okay, I'll be there. Just give him some tea and keep him there. I get my usual percentage. And don't worry, you get yours too. So, next slide, please. This is what they'd settle for. In this case, these are look like 8-inch bore, basically mortars. Mortars are cheap. Mortars are easy to use, easy to maintain. In this case, the Chinese have turned them into sort of de facto artillery by attaching them to Chinese cartwheels. So now they have sort of a kind of artillery piece. But again, mortars are easy, they're easy to maintain, they're easy to use, and they're a lot cheaper. And they get the job done. So mortars are more common, also mountain guns, you know, they're smaller, they're cheaper. And it's a cannon, it has prestige, and it goes bang, and it makes a nice explosion when the shell lands. And it might just cause an enemy unit to spook. Next slide, please. Now, this is what every warlord just had to have if he's a real player. An airplane! In fact, the warlords were big on acquiring airplanes. And this, of course, is where Sir ZZ and other players, the big players, like for Vickers, got into play in delivering airplanes. In fact, there was a big blow-up between Handley Page, Vickers, and the British government because Handley Page wanted to sell a bunch of airplanes to a warlord, and Vickers got upset because they were going to have the contract for airplanes. And, of course, the British government's excuse was basically, well, Vickers has a special working relationship with His Majesty's government, and we can't have everybody selling airplanes to the warlords because there is an arms embargo. So sorry, Handley Page, you can't sell your 0400s to transports. not bombers. No, they're not bombers. To the Chinese warlord up in the north. But this is an example. It's a rare photo. This is a Breguet 14, French-made light bomber. Again, 1920s, this is state-of-the-art. Combat aircraft in one of the warlord armies. Next slide, please. And what every warlord who's in the know owns. These belong to Chang So-Lin. Remember my pal from Manchuria? And notice these are burning tents, Mongol yurts, because he's showing them to behave themselves. You know, nomads, guess what? We send these clanking iron foreign devil monsters after you. This is actually a still from a film clip of the warlord tanks in action. And it is frequently used in documentaries, I've noticed over the decades, to represent the Japanese in Manchuria, conveniently ignoring the fact these are Chinese soldiers with Chinese equipment and uniforms. But anyway, the FT-17s were sold to Chang So-Lin. His rival, Wu Peifu, had Citroën Kigress half-track armored cars, and also at least one of the old Schneider CA-1 tanks was sold to Chang. They were, excuse me, I apologize. These are not tanks, really, folks. These are not tanks. They're agricultural tractors. That's what the box, the invoice on the box said when they went transited through Shanghai to go up to Manchuria by rail. They were sold as agricultural tractors because the Republic's government is supporting the embargo, you know. We cannot encourage the locals to kill each other. This is for plowing fields. Next slide, please. Okay, this is a reconstruction from one of the Osprey volumes on the Chinese Civil War armies. We have here a big prestige item for warlords, the armored train. Every warlord wants one. It's big, it's armored, it has cannons and machine guns. It's like a giant mechanical dragon. So every warlord wants one, and rails are important for transiting things around China because they're built by mainly the British. But they were. This is where the railroads come in. It is the main way, other than hoofing it on a dirt road across China, to move things from A to B. So there's a lot of fighting going on when the fighting goes on over control of rail hubs. Armored trains are important. And that's where this fellow comes in. Remember I mentioned the Russian expats? The Russians, mercenaries. Because many of them were the crew of armored trains, and that train happened to be a former Tsarist train. Well, I'm Wu Peifu. I'm going to buy the whole lot. I'll buy your train, you know. I'll buy you, your train, and your men. You all work for me. And we'll just paint my logo on it, and it's now mine. And they're mine. They work for me. And so we'll fly the flag of the Republic to make sure everybody understands that we are really, no, we're fighting for the Republic, not for my personal ambitions. Notice the mishmash of equipment here. We've got different rifles. We have a Mauser pistol. We have different styles of uniform, one to the other. The key identifier is the armband. You see, remember I mentioned how everybody usually has the Star of the Republic on their cap or uniform. Well, the way you differentiate one faction from another was always by their armband. Now, mind you, the armband was always conveniently attached very loosely. It's very easy to get rid of. Next slide, please. Here's a typical squad of government troops at the time. In other words, they're warlord troops. They look much the same. You'll notice that, among other pieces of standard issue equipment, are umbrellas. That's your shelter against the elements. You got an umbrella. Notice that there's a whole bunch of different assorted rifles in this picture that were identified. This is also from one of the Osprey books. It's just a great example of what your typical warlord soldier's outfit looked like. I mean, what a bunch of ragamuffins. Seriously. This one's a kit. I mean, boy soldiers were pretty common. I mean, the common denominator for these knuckleheads, God help them, was it beat starving. And, of course, they beat up on the peasants. They took what they wanted. These guys are probably, you know, they let the foreigner take the snapshot. Is he done? Okay, good. Now let's go get our dinner and let's just take what we want. Because the locals aren't going to argue with us. We've got guns. They don't. Don't say anything about the bullets. Next slide, please. Here's another example. China's armaments, the way they equip their soldiers and so on. And this is actually from the war with Japan. That's why the Americans supplied M1 steel trench helmets. We consider them obsolete. We're helping our ally China. Notice their weapons. There's no guns in sight. This is called a pudao, horse sword. It's basically a short, nasty blade, overlong sword blade on a short halberd. The tang runs all the way down. I own one, sharp enough to shave with. And it's designed to cut the legs out from under a horse. These guys have pudaos. They might have hand grenades. These are basically a shock troop unit. They were called either big sword or dare to die units. But yeah. You're going up against the Japanese, machine guns, automatic rifles, repeating rifles, with these. Next slide, please. This is not unusual. This is another example of warlord troops. These are warlord troops opposing Chiang Kai-shek's northern expedition. Again, notice the variance. These guys are pretty well uniformly equipped. These are probably a better unit within this particular warlord's army. I wasn't able to find or identify whose army this was. But notice the particular coolie hats. It's like uniform. This is a very well kitted out unit. So it's probably one of the better units. The better units would tend to be more uniform in equipment and attire. Next slide, please. Here we go again. These guys are from Wu Pei Fu's army. They have carbines, actually, not rifles, because, again, oh, I bought rifles. Why come they're so short? I sold you carbines, buddy. Because that's, again, catch as catch can. But here is just the training. Notice, again, they're fairly uniformly equipped, because Wu Pei Fu, remember, at his peak, he is part of the government, so he's got access to the funds. He negotiated those loans with the Japanese under the table. And, of course, his army was trained by the Japanese. So these are probably Arisaka carbines. Next slide, please. Another typical war soldier. This man would be from a dare to die unit or a big sword unit. Typical weapon fit for these assault troops is a sword and a pistol, usually the Mauser, and hand grenades. The big sword units of the Kuomintang had swords and grenades. Dare to die carried Mauser pistols and swords. These are the assault troops. You know, they're oftentimes actually very gung-ho, could be quite courageous in battle, as opposed to the majority who would tend to fire in the general direction of the enemy and try not to get too much attention drawn to them by the other side. Next slide, please. Again, a typical group of warlord soldiers all working for the same warlord. Notice again the complete dichotomy of attire and equipment. And this fellow has a Chinese broadsword, a dadao, hung on his back. Doesn't have a bayonet. See bayonets? That's a luxury item. So, besides, we've got all these traditional Chinese weapons to use, so, hey, I can't get a bayonet, I don't care. I've got a broadsword. So, that way, when I shoot my three bullets, I can still fight. But again, notice how hodgepodgey, that's really the point here, is that these armies are really can be ragtag. The same army, the unit quality will vary from reasonably well-trained professionals with uniform equipment, uniform attire, to, you know, bandits, glorified bandits who are just following you because you're feeding them this week. Next slide, please. And again, the ubiquitous umbrella. These are actually nationalist soldiers. You can recognize the nationalist sun wheel insignia. And again, quite well equipped and uniformly equipped. This is one of the better units, probably a showcase unit that they put out, march out for foreign dignitaries. Next slide, please. Here we go again. We see the parasol. I wasn't able to get this to fit, but this fellow's wearing sandals, whereas these guys have the split-toed shoe and putties. But again, these are three typical warlord soldiers. Steel helmets are very rare during the warlord period of the 20s. This was Wu Pei Fu's tin hat brigade, where he had one unit equipped with a helmet patterned after the French Adrian. Notice this one, he's got the Chinese broadsword on his back. It's got the blade that expands out as it gets to the end. It's a two-handed chopping sword, basically. This one has an MP-1820 submachine gun, one of the first ones it issued in the war, for the First World War. And again, popular weapon with the warlord troops. Makes a lot of noise. And of course, pistol bullets are cheap. Next slide, please. This is definitely high tech for a warlord army. Notice the advisor. But telephone system, communications? And actually, this guy's got a camera. But these are ostensibly warlord troops. But again, the star of the Republic. They are all fighting for the Republic. Long live the Republic. But foreign advisors, foreign mercenaries, common fixture. Next slide, please. Again, these fellows are Japanese. This has actually been to be a Japanese advisor. These troops from the north in Manchuria, part of Chang So Lin's organization. And so the Japanese influence is here. And you can kind of see he's actually trying to hold himself up some semblance of attention. The Japanese officer is speaking to him. Arisaka rifles are present. And notice you probably picked up the differences in colors of uniform cloth. Khakis, greens, blue-gray. I mean, when it fades, it goes gray. I mean, it's again, catch as catch can. China's a huge country. Over 90 ethnic groups, all speaking different dialects, so different from one another, they're practically different languages. This is why they have one thing in common, which is their written language. They can write to each other. But someone from Hunan, he won't understand someone from Fujian. Someone from Fujian can't speak to someone from Sichuan. They're like, huh? What did he say? But they can write. Next slide, please.
If they're literate.
Precisely. if they're literate. You couldn't get them guns? Didn't have enough guns to go around? Give them a spear. This was not at all unusual. They just give them a traditional tasseled spear and say, you're a soldier now. Fall in. Boy soldiers, one of the warlords toward the end, as the northern expedition was chewing up his territory and routing his armies, he was desperate for manpower. So, in fact, this is the fellow here. I can't quite read his name here. But the upshot is he recruited boys. Well, as you can predict, however enthusiastic or however well-intentioned those kids were, they're no match for the Kuomintang, it turned out, and that's why Shang defeated the warlords one by one. Next slide, please. Russian mercenary cavalryman. This fellow here is in Chang Solin's army. He was one of his elite bodyguards. He had them issued a green uniform. He had them issued lances, Mauser pistols, and Chinese swords, the Dadao again. Nasty weapon. I have one too. Great for slicing melons. But again, so this is part of the attraction. If you're a war gamer to this period, you have eclectic armies, you know, just an eclectic collection of mercenaries, your best troops, your body, your bog standard rank and file. The equipment is all over the map. It's Great War surplus. You might have aircraft. Chang Solin had nearly 100 of the latest aircraft available at the time in his private air force, including the Brigade 14 bombers that we looked at earlier, and he used them. He also tried to manufacture poison gas. He had set up, with French help, he had set up a chemical weapons factory and was producing mustard gas. He used it once in a battle with his rivals. And the reaction from every warlord in China was so intense that Chang made a great display of publicly dismantling his chemical weapons apparatus. He never used it again.
You have 5 minutes.
Thank you. Next slide. As the Kuomintang win, of course, remember everybody wants tanks. The Kuomintang has defeated the warlords. We're now in 1927. Japan is on the horizon. And so we get into the 30s. We start seeing Vickers, remember our friends Vickers having inroads in the Chinese market? Arms start to come flow into the new central government because China is now a unified nation. And of course, once again, it's a hodgepodge. Their affiliation with the Russians gets them Soviet T-26 tanks. Their relationships with the British get them the Vickers 6-ton and the Vickers Carden-Lloyd amphibious tank. These were one of the better tanks they had when the Japanese landed in Shanghai in 1937. They lost pretty much every one of them fighting the Japanese.
What's the M4 and the White Hat and the White Scout Rifle in there?
These come later. Lend-lease.
Okay.
When we get into the war, one of the first things we're doing is we're trying to help China. And so we start supplying them. And of course, this fellow here, they got some small numbers of M4s at the end of the Second World War, and just in time for the rematch between Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek. And that was the end of the Chinese Civil War in 1949. Mao wins. So thank you all very much. That really wraps it up.
You need to then run the game, like, you know.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Back in the 90s, I used to run games at conventions in the area, Warlords of China.
Did you run the game about factions in Shanghai?
No, I didn't do specifically Shanghai, but I've done multiplayer war games, Warlords of China, I call it. I used some modified Star Guard rules for the game, but everybody was a faction.
Yeah.
So I had two factions of gunrunners. I had two different groups of gunrunners. I had two different rival warlords. I had various mercenary units on a couple of Russian mercenary units on the table. So everybody had an opportunity to double deal and backbite, and they did. Yes, Ann?
When did Mao actually leave the Kuomintang and recruit his people?
The split came with a massacre in Shanghai.
Let me think, what year was that?
I think that was 27. They had the massacre. I got to go back through my notes.
So,
I'm great on personalities and weak on dates, but I'm trying to. Basically, when that split occurred was when Chiang Kai-shek decided, okay, you know what? You guys are out of the Kuomintang. I'm now in charge, and I'm not going to tolerate a riot. So that's when he sends the word down, and they march into the arm marches into Shanghai. The Green Gang's already alerted through his pal, Big Ear Du, and they just slam.
So where does Mao retreat to?
He went up to the Long March took him into the north. What was that remote province? There's one remote. I'm just blanking on it right now. No, it wasn't Manchuria. It's actually to the northwest. But it was. I think it was somebody say Shandong. I think it was Shandong.
So he worked with the local warlord who was there under, or just
basically at that point he had more power. I think after the Long March, he probably had more power, and it was an isolated rural area where he retreated to. Basically, once they got in there, they couldn't get him out.
Then he came back at the end. Okay.
He never stopped. Because here's the thing, Ian. He never stopped organizing.
Yeah.
He never stopped sending out people throughout the countryside. I mean, Mao's people were overwhelmingly peasants, so they fit right in.
It's just funny that he shows up in the 20s, and then all of a sudden there in 1949, he wins.
Because what he did, what he was doing was this. See, this is what drove the U.S. government crazy, especially Joseph Stilwell. Chiang Kai-shek would not commit the Chinese army to an all-out effort against the Japanese, even though they're invading his country.
Right.
They can't get him to move on this, because what Chiang's doing is, Chiang knows Mao's still out there.
Right.
And so Chiang is trying to save his strength and keep getting U.S. material and financial aid to build up his armies, and wait for the U.S. to defeat Japan, at which point it's round two, and he's going to get Mao Zedong.
Barbara Tuchman's book on Stilwell.
Thank you for mentioning that. It's a great book.
By the way, because that's what I remember Stilwell ranting about how can this guy possibly be asking for more goods? He's got warehouses of it. And that's why.
And in fact, speaking of the press, thank you for mentioning Barbara Tuchman. Stilwell and the American Experience in China. It's a fantastic book. Fantastic. Right in the last year of the war, the Japanese launched a huge offensive against China called Ichigo. And Ichigo, basically what happened was, because Chiang Kai-shek wouldn't commit the army to stop them in a serious way, Ichigo just kept going and going and going. Claire Chennault steps in and says, I can save you guys with air power alone. I've been advocating this all my life. So the U.S., I think it's the 14th Air Force, goes in, starts trying to attack the Japanese columns. Well, the Japanese already knew they had no air power. So they were moving at night and hiding during the day. The entire operational armies were hiding. As soon as they saw the sun coming up, they would all go to ground and disappear.
The Japanese didn't have air power?
It was almost non-existent by 1945.
Oh.
Yeah. So what's happening is, with Ichigo, is this was part of their operational planning. We move at night, we fight at night, and then we go to ground during the day. We stay out of sight, and let the Americans buzz around and bomb whatever thing they can see. And because of this, and because the Chinese were so ill-equipped and not sufficiently trained to put up a fight, because Chiang wouldn't commit them in enough numbers to put up a fight, they're just being steadily pushed back every day. And those warehouses you mentioned, full of American weapons, full of American equipment and food and medical supplies. The Japanese are capturing them, or the Chinese are burning them to keep them from being captured, because they're getting overrun so fast they can't evacuate them. And so hundreds of thousands of dollars, in today's dollars, millions of dollars in U.S. taxpayer supply aid to China is going up in smoke. Because Chiang Kai-shek would not fish or cut bait.
Thank you so much.
No, my pleasure. Thank you.